So, welcome everybody. I hope you can hear and see me. This is the fifth lecture in my course on the Arahant and the Four Truths in Early Buddhist Discourse. First of all, I again like to go through some of the points that during the very interesting contributions on the blog during the past week have been discussed. I have arranged this into a few main topics so that after each topic there's a chance for you to ask any questions, but please also feel free to just write your question when it comes, and once I have finished a topic I can always go back in the chat and see if there was anything. So the first topic is still, we are still with the putrid body and feeling disgust, which we started two lectures ago, and last lecture I went into that a little bit more. And there's still a few interesting comments. The first comment from Olga Gedrimait, I hope I pronounced the name properly. And she makes the observation for an arahant who has eradicated all the impurities, there's no more raga, no more dosa, no more moha, ignorance. So I'm asking myself, where from could disgust or repulsion arise if their roots are no more? Yeah, I thought that was quite to the point. She has basically succinctly expressed the problem that I also saw with those passages. Then there's a comment from Adam Clark. So he brings up the term Nibbida. And he says this term occurs quite often in the suttas. And this has been rendered in English as, e.g., disgust, aversion, revulsion, disenchantment, turning away, etc. Sounds like aversion at first glance. However, it is very often in the context of one's purifying one's mind, and often closely followed by dispassionate liberation. So it's meant usually as a wholesome attitude or practice. Yeah, in fact, I would very strongly argue, and I'm glad that Adam has brought that up, I would very strongly argue for translating Nibbida as disenchantment, and not as revulsion. There is one single passage, and I didn't have the time this morning after looking at the blog and everything to find it. There's one single passage, I think, where Nibbida does mean revulsion. It might be even one of these having a corpse hung around one's neck kind of passages. But the thing is, in the Pali discourses, we find that many terms are used with a certain range of meaning. So it is not possible for us to take one single passage, see what the meaning of that term there is, and then apply it to everything else. And I think Adam Clark is quite right in saying that the usual context where we get Nibbida, it is very closely related to dispassion, and one is on the brink of liberation. And so my personal preferred translation of this term would be disenchantment, losing interest, but it's a letting go, not a pushing away, which is what at least I would associate with the term revulsion. And now we get into what this practically means. This is from Rodolfo Rivas Molina. And he says, my big question is, how do you balance asubha, that is the contemplation of the absence of beauty, no self impermanence in the practice, so you can find the happiness to keep you going? And then he makes a very humorous sketch of where one might end up if one doesn't do that. It's just he's a little bit exaggerating for us to get his point. He says, there's no self and your body is pestilent. You are a walking corpse. Beauty is a perception out of ignorance. And don't even think of committing suicide, because if you die in a violent manner, that just makes things even worse. Yeah, I had to crack when I read this. Yeah, perhaps before I give my reply, I quote someone else who has already said something very pertinent, and then I come with my ideas. Yeah, I first quote. This is Linda Grace. She says, I find that as we start to see more how we are attending to experience in terms of what is being cultivated, we naturally incline more towards that which is supportive. I think it is very important to remember and actually cultivate the conditions for joy and inspiration to arise. I think the Buddha was a genius in recognizing the role of pleasure and our need for nourishment. Yeah, and this is also my feeling. So I think I'm very much on these bodhjhangas, the awakening factors, seven awakening factors, and I'm in fact at present writing on them. I'm writing a new book on Satipatthana, and you see, when I did my original Satipatthana research 10 years ago, the bodhjhangas, the awakening factors, was the topic on which I found was less being covered by other scholars, and also I didn't have much to say on it at that time because I was relying on other writings. But from my own practice and also from the emphasis given to these seven qualities that lead to awakening in the early discourses, it seems to be more or less like the most important of all. And now if you look at these awakening factors, there are seven altogether. The basic one, the number one, is mindfulness. But then the one in center position is joy. Joy is extremely important. And if we look at the whole dynamics of these seven as they build up, they first kind of move through a more insight type of mental qualities. There's investigation and effort. Then there comes joy. And then there come these more tranquility-related qualities, like tranquility, in fact, and concentration. And they culminate in equanimity. And so if we just look at this dynamics, I think there's a number of quite interesting conclusions we can draw from that. One is that insight meditation certainly is going at times to lead through periods of feeling negative or feeling sad, but in the long run it has to lead to joy, otherwise there's something wrong. Either the practice is not balanced or we are overdoing it. And so if we get into this situation that Rodolfo has so beautifully described, there's no self, my body is pestilent, and etc., etc., very clearly something is wrong. Very clearly that we are either the insight is not practiced properly or we are overdoing it. The insight needs to at some point lead to the joy of detachment, the joy of letting go. And that is how we balance these. But again, the bodhjhangas make it clear that the top is equanimity, the letting go of and the equipoise of upekkha. So joy is not the final goal, but joy is kind of like the hub of the wheel. It's right in the center of the bodhjhanga development. And joy is the basis for concentration, for samatha. Once the mind is joyful, it naturally concentrates. So seeing that insight and tranquility are actually not different, totally different compartments of Buddhist meditation practice, but are complementary qualities, and the linking point of the two is joy. And looking at this joy from these two sides, I think is in my own practice, I would say, is what really helps me to balance out. Yeah, so there's a comment by Dania. So are the seven bodhjhangas practiced and developed in a linear manner, one thing based on another, or developed simultaneously? Dania, there's a whole range for the bodhjhangas. You see, in one way, if you look at the Anapanasati Sutta, Mindfulness of Breathing, Majjhima Nikaya 118, you find that they build on each other, one leads to the other. But then you look at the Venerable Sariputta, and he says he can decide at any time of the day whichever of the bhujangas, the awakening factors, he wants to dwell in, just as a rich person or a king's minister is able to choose a garment from his wardrobe and say, I'll put on this one today and I'll put on that one tomorrow. So I think the bhujangas, the awakening factors, is a very dynamic thing. You can develop one of them, then you develop another one, you can build them up. I'm going to write on this, so if I tell you everything now, we won't get to the topic of the lecture, and I still have to put this all together, but at least I want to say that I think the bhujangas are crucially important. They are really central in the practice, and that this one aspect I wanted to highlight is the joy thing. Joy as something that somehow, as Linda already said, it's something that has to be there with the practice. Not every time. There are times when we see that when the insight gets strong, then there's a real like, oof, kind of feeling. And that is perfectly fine. I'm not saying that. But in the long run, the purpose of insight is to lead to detachment, to inner freedom. And there's a joy that comes from that. And if that joy is not there, if it gets all dreary and grey and kind of grit your teeth thing and work this way to liberation stuff, then there's something wrong. And it's not going to work, as far as I can tell. Yeah, so now I'm leaving the disgust. Yeah, Danya, this is not a paper. This is a whole book I'm writing, and I hope it's coming out next year. I'll let you have a copy when it's out. Stuart Cornyn, I'm wondering if we might say that almost by definition, Arahant must be repelled by future existence, rebirth, and at the same time, again, almost by definition, must abide in joy's equanimity in current existence. Well, Stuart, I think last time I quoted this passage from the Itivuttaka where it said that feeling disgust for existence is one extreme. Delighting in existence is the other extreme. So I think it's just not a matter for the Arahant. The Arahant is not interested in living longer or living shorter. He or she is just handles things as they are and just feels free with that. The aim of the practice formulated in the ancient Indian context is to go beyond rebirth, yes. That is certainly the case. But I still would not think that the Arahant feels repelled. It's just disenchanted. I think we are probably saying the same thing, and I'm playing the fool by pinpointing words. Yeah. Let's use the Pali word. Let's use nibbida. And you translate it as repelled, and I translate it as disenchanted, and here we are. He has or she has nibbida for any kind of existence. Okay, thank you. Got my way around, you know. Yeah, now we are getting into another topic. Two practitioners have brought up ideas that I would like to discuss briefly, because these are, you see, the whole point I'm trying to do in this course with my writings is to access this so-called early Buddhism, to try to stay at that sutra level. Comparative study, seeing the development between the Chinese and the Pali, but to see where this takes us, and then where the commentarial tradition of the Theravada or other Buddhist traditions sets in, what their ideas are. And with that, I'm not in any way, this is not a value judgment. The commentaries have a very important function, very interesting perspectives, important for the practice also. I'm just trying to show what, because normally, you see, everybody approaches the discourses through these looking glasses of the commentaries, and I'm just kind of wanting to take off this looking glass and let us look at the material itself, and then please put back the glasses if you want the glasses. So there's one such point which Giuliano Martini had been quoting, this idea that the presence of mindfulness rules out the contemporary presence of any reactive pattern of the mind, like disgust. Yeah, and this is a very important position taken in the commentaries of the Theravada tradition, but I'm happy that Giuliano quoted this position, but that gives me the opportunity for saying that this is not the way what we get in the suttas, as far as I'm able to tell. And this is actually quite important. Behind this idea stands the fact that the Theravada tradition considers mindfulness something that is only wholesome. It can only be wholesome. And this is a position taken only in the Theravada tradition. Other Buddhist traditions see that differently. And in the discourses itself, we get explicit reference to miccha sati, to wrong sati, wrong forms of mindfulness, which makes it a little difficult to think that this is wholesome. And there's a practical problem related to that. You see, the whole idea on which the commentarial type of explanations are based is this, they call it the cittaviti, this succession of mind moments. The idea is that there's one mind moment and immediately it passes away, and there's another mind moment, it passes away, another mind moment, it passes away. Very quick succession of these mind moments. And so the idea is, say, mind moment one, there's anger. Then in that mind moment itself, no way, mindfulness cannot be there. Only in mind moment two, mindfulness can be there, and it looks kind of back on what happened before and says, oh, there was anger. And from a practical perspective, however, I have found in my experience working with meditators in Asia that this sometimes gives the idea that either you meditate, so you are mindful and there are no defilements, or if you have defilements, it automatically means you are not being mindful and you are not practicing. And this is a real problem, because the whole potential of mindfulness unfolds precisely at the moment when there is something unwholesome in the mind, being aware of it. That is so absolutely crucial, important, central, necessary. No more words. Yeah, it's in my own practice and seeing how other people practice, it's absolutely essential. And this is what the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on mindfulness meditation, tells us. At the moment of having lust, he or she knows, I have lust. At the moment of having anger, he or she knows, I have anger. So I personally feel that it is important to see the function and importance of this commentarial idea that mindfulness is only wholesome, but to see that in the early discourses this is not the idea of mindfulness we get, and whichever of the two notions of mindfulness one wants to employ, to be careful not to let arouse this type of misunderstanding that I just sketched. And behind this idea of mind moments, there is another thing that I also want to wait. There's a question. Maybe I go for that first. Mark, are these mind moments from Abhidhamma viewpoint or from later commentaries such as Buddhaghosa? The full-fledged theory of the cittaviti, do you only get, as far as I know, with the Abhidhammata Sangaha, a 12th century commentary? No, but it is already in Visuddhimagga there. The canonical Abhidharma, I am not sure if there is an incipient theory of the cittaviti there. Now, I can't tell you offhand. there's a shift between the canonical Abhidharma and later Abhidharma works and the commentaries. So it's definitely there with Buddha Ghosa and all the Pali commentaries. When they interpret the suttas, they will rely on this Chittaviti idea. But my basic feeling right now is that it might not yet be there, at least as a clear-cut theory in the canonical Abhidharma. How far it is there in an incipient stage, I would have to look up the books. I am not able to tell you offhand. Juliana, thank you for this clarification. My comment was not really denying that one can have an unwholesome state and know it, but was referring to the mindfulness of an arahant. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Juliana, I was not contradicting you in any way. It was just an occasion, because this came up as part of the discussion, and I just wanted to use this as an opportunity to discuss this issue of mindfulness. And there's another related idea that Sauda Ardavas brought up. It's similarly based on this moment-by-moment theory. Then the belief that since the mental phenomena arise one by one, a happiness is actually always in the past or in the future, but never now. That is to say, when we experience ourselves. Yeah, it's the same. You see, it's the same basic idea. And I just want to again say that this is not the position that we get in the suttas. In the early discourses, the idea of momentariness is not found. And here I'm on firm ground also in saying that it's not even found in the canonical Abhidharma. It comes only with the Abhidharma commentaries and Buddha Ghosa. The basic idea of impermanence that we get in the early discourses is just change. Things change, but they do not necessarily disappear on the spot, which is the idea of momentariness. Something is there, gone, chum, chum. So if I picture that, I have this simile that I like to use for that. The conception of impermanence in later tradition, the theory of momentariness, is like a flickering lamp. On, off, on, off, on, off, on, off. The conception of impermanence in the early suttas is like a flowing river. Continuous change, but the river is not there for a moment and disappears, it just keeps on flowing. And this is actually a canonical simile. I'm using the second one, not the flickering lamp. And here I give you the reference. It's in the Anguttara Nikaya, among the 70s discourse, Anguttara Nikaya 437 in the PTS edition. There's several similes to explain the brevity of life. And one of these similes speaks of a mountain river. It flows, and it does not stop even for a moment. Kana, exactly what they use for the momentariness, kanika. Not for a moment, not for an instant, not for a second. So life is like a flow that does not stop for a moment, for an instant, for a second. I think it is very clear that this passage came into being at a time when the idea of momentariness had not yet arisen. And then there is another passage, also in the Anguttara Nikaya, among the threes of Discourse 47, this is volume 152 page of PTS edition, where we are taught that there are three marks of conditioned existence. One is that it arises, one is that it disappears, and the other is the otherwiseness of that which persists. So there's an arising, there's a disappearance, but in between there is a change while the thing is still there. So nothing permanent, nothing unchanging. Change is always there. But not everything disappears on the spot. Some things might disappear on the spot, but not everything. And I think it is important to when we approach the material that we are going through in this course, I think it's important for us to keep in mind that we are operating with this flow type of impermanence idea at the background, and that we are operating with this mindfulness that can coexist with unwholesome states in order for us to understand the thought of early Buddhism. And I hope that with these explanations I have not been giving any kind of value statement that the commentaries are wrong or that the momentariness is not proper. All these ideas have their meaning and their context within which they arise, and for those who operate with them, these are very meaningful, and I do not want to discuss that. It's just that my task here, what I have set myself as a task, is just to try to see what do we get in early Buddhism, and then from there we have a way of looking at, okay, and my tradition developed in this way, and this person's tradition developed in that way, and this is how these other ideas came into being. It's just this. In the academic circle, we call it the critical historical perspective, to see to what historical period certain ideas belong. That is all. Yeah, and in relation to this topic of change also, there was the theme of time. What is time? Sauda Ardavas and Rodolfo Rivas Molina both raised this topic. And the suttas say very little about time. Wait, there's a question by Mark. I don't understand how the Chittavitti idea means that sati can only be with wholesome mind states. No, Mark, I probably explained myself in an unclear manner. The starting point is that mindfulness is defined as always wholesome. And this reflects probably the practical experience that sometimes when you become mindful of an unwholesome state, it disappears. But then the theory works like this, that it says, okay, when mindfulness is present, the unwholesome, there's this idea that one state of mind can only have one ethical quality. Either it's wholesome or it's unwholesome. So once you have, say, the bad guy, anger, then the good guy, mindfulness, can't be in the same room. And once you get the good guy, mindfulness, then anger, lust, the bad guys, no way they can be in the same room. And to explain the empirical experience we have of realizing I'm just getting angry, I'm just getting lustful, then comes in this Chittavitti kind of thing where the idea is, okay, the bad guy is in the last room, the good guy is in the next room, but the good guy is able to look back and see, ah, look, there was anger. I hope I have been able to give the basic idea, but I'm not wanting to go into that any longer. Okay, I'm sorry, sometimes the way I explain is, we don't say what it is, no? So I'm back to the topic of time. We are still with Anguttara Nikaya, today is Anguttara Day. Among the three is number 67, this is in the PTS edition, volume 1, page 197. And so what we are being told about time is there's three topics you can discuss. Past, future, present. Profound, eh? Yeah, but I think actually it's quite significant that suttas do not go much further into this topic of time. And so now comes my interpretation, and you are certainly most welcome to criticize or contradict. As far as I understand, time is nothing else but our conceptualization of change. So, if that is all, the dimension of change added to the three dimensions, then in fact there's not really much to be said about it apart from something has changed, something is changing, and something will change. That's all. So, I hope I'm forgiven, but this huge problem, philosophical problem of time, I seem to have missed out on the problem because it seems to me fairly simple. But I'm sure that on the blog somebody will be able to bring out the deeper aspects. Maybe I've just overlooked something. And then Rodolfo also said about the cyclic conception of time. And this is something that we get stronger in the Indian thought. The Indian thought has a more cyclic conception of time, the Western a more linear way, and these are just different ways of looking again at change. You see, you can look at summer, winter, summer, winter, summer, winter, and that is the cyclic aspect of change. Day, night, day, night, day, night, that is the cyclic aspect of change. But I can also look at last course 2011, this course 2012, next course 2013. There's a linear aspect. So change has these two aspects, and it simply depends on our cultural conditioning which of these two we give more emphasis or importance to, which in turn then is important for us to understand certain ideas. Like when we read Buddhism, we know at the background stands a more cyclic conception of time that makes it easier to appreciate certain ideas. But the one does not exclude the other. It's just a matter of emphasis. Yeah, I've not finished with my time, but I finished with the topic of time. And yeah, then I go to the next. Now we are back with our discourse, Gulisani, and the proper conduct of a forest monk. You remember this forest monk who comes, and then Sariputta is giving him this indirect teaching. Oh, Danya, totally agree with you on time. Neuroscience experiments show how the mind creates moments of time, etc. Thank you, Danya. So, Gulisani. Juliana, very good. The Dhamma is timeless because it is to know the stability of the law of change. This is a comment by Wayne Cho. She said, one should also realize that by practicing, one is also teaching by example. This is definitely one of the best ways to teach. We are still with this idea of the conduct of the forest monk and how he should behave in a certain way that is finds approval with the others. And then there was Mark Johnson, who really hit me during the last course with his observation on qualities 2 to 6 to be reflecting a little bit what happens when somebody comes out of retreat. And I thought it was just one of those wonderful remarks that make me really happy that I'm doing this course because I'm able to learn from you. Yeah, and he just adds that, these qualities 2 to 6 in the Madhyama Agama version give us this impression that they could be due to a forest monk or a monk in retreat coming out of the forest or out of his retreat and then overindulging in things like food and talking. And then he makes another comment which I thought was quite to the point. Excuse me. He says, also, many meditation practices seem to be designed in such a way that they are easy to practice while in isolation, but difficult to practice upon re-entering the busy world. So people do not always have the full support of their practice to help them keep their balance when they leave the quiet of retreat. Yeah, I think that is actually quite a problem. And it's a real challenge to bridge the intensive retreat to the daily life. Still, it is crucially important to go for retreat. Yeah, and then there was a remark by Bhikkhuni Suvimali. She is actually my co-conducting teacher. She looks after the students in Sri Lanka who are doing this course. So I'm always very happy we have some communications, and sometimes she also makes remarks on the lectures, and I like to share that with you. So she says, it appears to me that the underlying meaning in the Gulisani Sutta is not only external conduct for the increase in confidence in the Dhamma and Sangha. The Gulisani Sutta develops on external conduct so that it becomes good behavior, which is a manifestation of mental discipline. This underscores what a forest meditating monk should try to attain, higher morality, the higher mind, and the higher wisdom, she gives the Pali terms. Yeah, I thought that was a good point that and this is she is a nun, I'm a monk, so I can fully understand that. For us monastics, is the adopting of proper external conduct is an important part of the practice, because it helps us also to develop those inner qualities. So it's part of our own training. It is not only meant to be inspiring and pleasing to others. Yeah, that was the topic of Gulisani. And now we're coming closer to the Brahma Viharas. If there's no... hope I haven't missed anybody. No. Good. Then we go for the Brahma Viharas. This is from Lisa Fancott. She says, you remember maybe at the end of last lecture I had spoken about compassion, and I had been trying to explain the somewhat different flavor of the Brahma Viharas by saying that metta, loving kindness or benevolence, is more kind of like on an evil level. And compassion is somewhat, I'm in a stronger position, so I'm somewhat, has a somewhat downward looking kind of energy, and sympathetic joy, usually towards somebody who is in a stronger or better situation, has a more upward looking kind of nuance to it. And she says that I don't think of the two energies as upward or downward. In my experience, metta radiates from an inner source outwards. It is a natural arising and does not have to be in reaction to anything. Compassion is an energy Compassion is an energy process generated upon contact with an outer object, with an object or situation. It takes what arises and transforms it so that what is produced, energy radiated outward and the karma of body, speech or mind, is skillful. Yeah, I just thought that was interesting. I mean, I certainly would also say that metta radiates from an inner source outwards, as do compassion and the others. But I am, and this is a, she's touching on a topic that we are still going to be discussing now, about this, like how much does one need an object, and how much what is actually happening in the meditation, and what is in the interrelation with others. Yeah, I would not see. I think metta can also be in reaction to something, in my experience. And the compassion need not be based on a contact with an object or a situation. And I mean, this is the perspective we get in the suttas, where compassion is clearly something practiced in as part of the Brahma Viharas in a meditative setting, where there is not necessarily an object or situation that calls it up. And we also get that somebody should have metta in certain situations by body, speech and mind, in as response to the situations. And when I was saying upward and downward, I was not meaning the actual meditative experience of the radiation, but I was just saying how when these qualities are practiced, engaged in relation to others, then this is the kind of hierarchy, maybe, that we get. And hierarchy is not a nice word. The kind of placing, if we place ourselves in three-dimensional space, metta would be something like meeting on the same level, more or less. Mitra, being a friend. This basic idea of, like, I don't harm you and you don't harm me, let's be friends. Whereas compassion is more like I'm standing on the firm ground and somebody else is sinking in the mud and I'm pulling him or her out. This is what I mean with this downward kind of thing. And mudita, sympathetic joy, would then be more kind of somebody else is doing so well that I might feel jealous, but instead of feeling jealous, I rather just rejoice. We had that, I think Linda brought that up with last time with the Sariputta, these examples about resentment, and then the last example, somebody is totally pure. Still it's possible to have resentment. But a much better response, instead of jealousy and resentment, would be the sympathetic joy. And then Sarda Ardavars, he just made a comment on compassion. He said, the common understanding of compassion as sentimental contemplation, feeling sorry or anything for others, is not the real thing. It's only an emotional self-indulgence. Yeah, this is a danger also recognized in the commentarial tradition, I believe. I'm not against the commentaries. Some good stuff there. One has to be careful with the development of compassion, that it doesn't get into with suffering with the others. That it doesn't get into this kind of what Ardavas there describes. Yeah, and then Manfred Wiesberger brought up this whole topic of what is actually metta, what is karuna, what is mudita. And I'm just quoting a small extract from what he had on the blog. So he says, the closest I get to a feeling of karuna is with the illusory wish that I and all beings may be free from suffering. This too feels different from active karuna and is also, because of the wish involved, very different from metta. As for mudita, sympathetic joy, I see a happy, joyful being and get infected with happiness and joy. This is just joy, no? Not different from waking up happy because of a good night's sleep and the morning sunshine. But is it mudita? Mudita, by its mental quality and also philologically, is very, very close to normal types of joy. Anumodana, rejoicing. It's the same mood, the same root. But when we really look at the mind, if I'm just happy because of a good night's sleep and the morning sunshine, there's a different quality to that joy in terms of wholesomeness and unwholesomeness and mental cultivation. And I think it's good that Manfred brought this up. The qualities are close, but I believe that with continuous practice, the distinction between mudita and ordinary type of joy becomes clearer. But mudita is also closely related to the piti thing, the joy that I was mentioned before as bojanga. It's a little difficult to completely cut these into separate categories. Stuart Corner says, I'm wondering, this ties in with the near enemies of the Brahmaviharas. Exactly. Thank you, Stuart. That was exactly what I had in mind. And the association of karuna with the wish that all beings may be free from suffering is obviously very strong for all of us, because that is the way we are usually being taught about karuna. But when I practice, I am not really engaging in thoughts about beings and may they be free from suffering or not free from suffering. It is, for me, simply just an opening of the heart towards those who are not well, in whatever way or situation. So there's no volitional push in there, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, I'm myself just trying to tap around. And an important thing that Linda Grace brought up about the question of objects. And she says, even if initially called forth in response to an object, the object is then naturally dropped, but the mind state remains accessible. Yeah, that is precisely what I think. So there's no question that these qualities need to be developed without any reliance on object, just that the object helps to arouse the mental state. And with further practice, one less and less needs an object until one is able to directly access the mental state. And there's a longer comment by Giuliana Martini, and then we are at the end with the blog. So she says, although mudita or karuna, that is sympathetic joy and compassion, would be initiated by an object or a response to a life experience. Nonetheless, when you just let the feeling spark take over and expand, the object is gone anyway. Once we are familiar with the taste of the experience, it's easier meditatively to let it arise again. Yeah, that is also what I feel, that there's no need to say no object from the outset, but seeing that the object is a crutch, and once I'm able to walk on my 2 feet, I don't need the crutch anymore. And she says also, and this is another important observation, I also find it useful to look at them from the point of view of what defilement or obstacle prevents them from arising, and in the absence of which defilement or obstacle, each of them can characteristically express itself. I mean, if there's genuine harmlessness in me, and I focus my attention on recollecting this virtue, it's easier for compassion to manifest. If I am free from envy, likewise, sympathetic joy can arise. That is a very, very clever approach, I think, and that is also what Stuart just said about the near enemies, that if the arousing of a particular Brahma-vihara, one of these divine abodes, is difficult, as quality as such, there is the roundabout way of going from the other side, from that which is its near enemy or which is the obstacle that prevents it, and from letting go of that, then the thing can arise. But basically what I was briefly already saying last time is that in the suttas we get a lot of emphasis on the first one, metta, on loving kindness, or I prefer benevolence. So if in the practice this comes naturally, then I think that's fine. And with time, one will become more familiar with that in the practice and in daily life situations. And then the distinction between metta and the other two, between benevolence, loving kindness, and compassion or sympathy, joy, become clearer. And then these become also part of the formal practice. Lisa Fancourt, is it wrong view to look at their functionality and context? And how do they take on different shades and qualities if they arise without an object? Lisa, I don't understand the first part about looking at their functionality and context. And the thing about not having an object is what we are going to come to when we go through this discourse now, where there is this description of the way how in the suttas the Brahma-viharas are being practiced without an object and as a boundless radiation, which is quite different to the way this is usually being taught based on the commentary model of having a particular formulated emotional ideas towards separate persons. And the functionality and context thing, maybe... Yeah, maybe how would karuna be different from metta if there's no object? It feels different. It has a different feeling to it. I can't quote a sutta. I can just only say, see, I'm meditating and it feels different. Very subjective. Can't help it. It does feel different. It has a very different feeling to it. Yeah, somehow the metta is, it's very difficult to say, but the metta really has this benevolence, wishing, this friendness, not friendliness, friendness, maybe. And compassion, there's a, it's a little bit more salty. I'm sorry, can't come up with a stupid thing to say, but I don't know, it's a, yeah, it's when this, yeah, I can't describe it. I'm sorry. It just I would know whether in a daily life situation or in meditation on reflecting, I would know, is this right now metta, benevolence, or is it compassion, or is it sympathetic joy? I can tell that from the flavor in my mind, but I can't describe these flavors. Juliana makes a very good point. She says that in the meditation, it is precisely metta, loving kindness, benevolence, or compassion, which are the object. So this shouldn't be a problem. The qualities are different based on the Brahma Vihara, no? Yeah. Right. So we are ready to go for discourse, I think. Oh, there's a question by Mark. I take the chance to drink. No question, then we hit the discourse. We're good in time. Excuse me. So, Majjhima Agama 27. Mark is asking about mudita. Seems like it needs another. Not when you practice it in meditation. The mudita itself, as Juliana says, becomes the object. To understand what it means, it's good to use another as the object to develop that quality, and then we are able to recognize it. But once you're able to recognize it, it's like a map in a foreign city. You need the map to find the way, but once you have been to Kendi 10 times now, you know your way. You don't need the map anymore. And so I don't need the object anymore. Then sometimes, obviously, in everyday interrelation, it comes up. It is related to people. There's no question about that. But in the actual formal meditation, I do not need an other person or as an object. It's the mind itself that becomes the object. Right. So we go for our discourse. Yeah, sitting at the background to this discourse, we have Majjhima Agama 27, which is the parallel to the Dhananjani Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. And our Venerable Sariputta, chief disciple of the Buddha, is in Sarvati, one of the main places where the Buddha and the monks were staying. And another monk comes, and this monk has been spending the rainy season retreat, the 3 months where monks stay in one place, at Rajgarh, another big town in ancient India. And the Buddha has also been in Rajgarh. So the Sariputta now inquires about the well-being of the people that this monk has been spending the rains with. And in the Majjhima Agama discourse, he inquires after the well-being of the Buddha, of other monks and nuns, of male and female lay disciples, of non-Buddhist recluses and Brahmins, and of the Brahmin Dhananjani, the protagonist of the discourse that we are getting into. And this beginning, you see here the Pali version, he is not so interested in the lay disciples, and he does not inquire after the recluses and Brahmins, but here just he wants to know how is the Buddha, how are the monks, and how is the Brahmin Dhananjani. And even though the Pali discourse does not have this inquiry, how are the male and female lay disciples, the discourse as such is a very clear testimony for the concern of the monastic community for lay people. And therefore this inquiry by Sariputta fits the context well. The fact that the Pali version does not mention nuns need not be seen as a gender problem. Often we find that it's part of the idiom that just the expression bhikkhu is used, but it implies any monastics. So it also implies novices, nuns, novice nuns. So one passage I recently came across where there's a group of bhikkhunis, nuns, and they tell Venerable Ananda that they are seriously practicing satipatthana, mindfulness, and the Buddha then tells Ananda tells this to the Buddha, and then the Buddha in reply says, ah, very good, very good, and then starts to talk about how a monk practices mindfulness. As obviously that, as before, bhikkhunis, nuns have been mentioned, this is not meant to exclude them. It's just a way how, apparently in ancient India, things were formulated. Like say, if all of the participants in the course that are now online, there is one monk, then I would, if we would be in ancient India, I would not say, hello everybody, but I would say, hello monks! I'm not going to say that. That is just an idiom, so it need not be taken too serious. But I still find it interesting that the Madhyama Agama, a general pattern, it more often mentions monks and nuns. In the Pali discourses, it's more typical that they just talk about monks. Good, but now we get to our Brahman Dhananjani. So after Sariputta has asked, then he's told everybody else as well, but... So the monk replies, I read the discourse for you. Venerable Sariputta, the Brahmin Dhananjani from Rajgaha is healthy and strong. He is comfortable and free from ailments. He is dwelling at ease and his vigor is as usual. However, he does not wish to see the Buddha, nor does he delight in hearing the Dharma. Why is that? Venerable Sariputta, the Brahmin Dhananjani has not been making efforts and has been transgressing against the moral precepts. Relying on his standing with the king, he defrauds the Brahmins and householders. And relying on his standing with the Brahmins and householders, he defrauds the king. Yeah, the Pali version tells us that this bad behavior of the Brahmin is because he's married a new wife who is no longer Buddhist, and this is an information we get also later in the Madhyama Agama version. And now the thing that Sariputta does is he decides to go, well, that's quite a distance from Savatthi to Rajgaha, he decides to go there to visit Dhananjani on the next possible occasion. I think this is, again, this is the topic we are discussing, the Arahant. And this is again shows, you see, this is just somebody he knows, a former friend, but he hears this person is having problem with morality. So he decides, let me go and talk to him. It's not this kind of, I'm an Arahant, I'm a monk, let these lay people do what they want. So he approaches Dhananjani and inquires about his conduct. And then when he's asked about that, our Brahmin Dhananjani then tries to excuse himself. I read the discourse. Sariputta, know that being at present a householder, I have to manage my household affairs. I have to see to, and then he lists various things that he has to look after. His own comfort and well-being. Yes, I have to support my parents. I have to look after my wife and children. I have to provide for my male and female servants. I have to pay taxes to the king. I have to perform rituals for the deities. I have to make offerings to my departed ancestors. I have to give to recluses and Brahmins in order to live long and later be reborn in heaven and obtain pleasant karmic fruits. Sariputta, all these affairs cannot be neglected. So while this puts us squarely into the situation of a layperson living out in the world who says, look, there are so many things I have to look after. Nowadays, we don't have to do rituals for deities or offerings for our departed ancestors, but paying taxes, looking after one's family, problems for anybody who lives a lay life. And there's this question that we are now going to be practical again, how to combine living a lay life in which one meets one's responsibilities with the sometimes rather high requirements on moralities imposed on us by Buddhist discipline. There's always a question how to negotiate these two demands. Yeah, here we look at the Pali version. One interesting difference you see in the Madhyama Agama, my own comfort and well-being is first. In the Pali, he's more diplomatic, he puts that last. So in the Pali version, he mentions that he has to look for after his parents, after his wife and children, after his servants. Then there come three here, I have put in bold because they are not in the Chinese version. He has to look after friends, relatives and guests. Then again, the topic of looking after dead ancestors, that is providing food for them according to ancient Indian custom, making offerings to gods, paying taxes to the king, and to look after himself. Yeah, you're already used to that now with me, that we always, when we do this comparison, we always get this main topic is similar, but then there are always these smaller differences. Something is here, something there. Daniel says, how come the Pali version doesn't have looking after monastics? Yeah, I'm not able to explain why a certain topic is mentioned in one version or in the other version. You are quite right that we would expect that. But the reasons why during the long period of oil transmission something might got lost or was added is a little difficult to assess now. But I mean, what we can take away from this is, again, there's some variations as we are now familiar with from comparative studies, but there is this main topic of the responsibilities one has as a layperson in life, and that Dhananjani says, look, you can't take me up on doing some little bit irregular things because I have my responsibilities. And underneath that, I don't know if that is the case with Dhananjani, but it is sometimes when discussions are between laity and monks, there is this little thing like, you monks, you don't understand. You are there getting your food and robes from us, and you don't have to meet all these responsibilities, so we know what it is to be out in the world. And there is something to that. But still, our Sariputta is now going to make it clear that morality is more important. And he does that by asking him a number of questions in the Madhyama Agama. I read the discourse. Then the Venerable Sariputta said, Dhananjani, let me ask you a question. Answer as best you can. What do you think, Dhananjani? Suppose that someone does evil for the sake of his parents. Having done evil, he goes at the breaking up of the body at death to a bad realm of existence, being reborn in hell. Once reborn in hell, he is dragged off by the wardens of hell to undergo harsh punishment. He pleads with the wardens of hell. Wardens of hell, let me tell you, don't punish me. Why? Because I did evil only for the sake of my parents. What do you think, Dhananjani? Will that person be able to escape punishment by the wardens of hell by pleading so? Dhananjani replied, no. So the same argument we get now, if this person goes to hell and says, look, I did it for my wife and children, I did it for my servants, I did it to pay taxes to the king, to give offerings to the deities and departed ancestors, or to support recluses and Brahmins. In all these cases, he is not able to get off. Again, now we translate this situation, we are not so much maybe concerned about hell, or maybe not all of us believe in hell, but the main point is that doing something for the sake of others does not absolve us from the karmic responsibility of what we do. This is the point that is being made here in the discourse. Dania is asking if this description of hell is metaphorical. I was always wondering that about the suttas. If we create these experiences, and how much is this realm created outside of our mental creation? Yeah, this is a much discussed issue, Dania, but I mean, as far as we are able to tell, it seems that in ancient India they did believe in heaven and hell. And so the idea that this Brahmin and this Buddhist monk would have been sharing a similar type of cosmology in which there is heaven, there is hell, and where the question that when you do something bad you end up in hell is not being disputed. This does not mean that you need to believe in hell to make sense of this discourse. That was what I was just trying to say. But I don't think it would be doing justice to the early discourses if we take all these as being meant originally in a metaphorical sense. You are certainly free to interpret it in a metaphorical sense for yourself. But I think for us to, what we are trying to do here, for us to first step, let's try to understand what this 2,500 years ago probably arisen and some few centuries later written down or translated, what these texts say in their time. And then, and I hope I don't forget that, always trying to make the step, then what does this mean for us in our modern day situation? How can we make sense of that? So he continues, Sariputta, he says, excuse me, Dhananjani, a clansman can gain wealth by means that are in accordance with the Dharma, in accordance with creating good karma, and in accordance with virtue, in order to honor, respect, and support his parents, thus performing meritorious acts and abstaining from unwholesome acts. Dhananjani, if a clansman gains wealth by means that are in accordance with the Dharma, he is thought of fondly by his parents, who say, may you have good health and a long life. Why do we say this? Because thanks to you we have peace and happiness. Dhananjani, for one who is thus thought of fondly by his parents, merits increase daily and do not decline. So here Sariputta is not only bringing in the aspect of karma, but also saying it will also be better in the present moment. If you are supporting your parents with unwholesome means, this will also affect the way how your parents experience this support. But if you do it in a wholesome way, you will be more at peace. It will be more wholesome. It will also affect them, and they will be more able to rejoice in that. And then we get the same again, wife and children, males and female servants, the king, deities, departed ancestors, recluses and Brahmins. Yeah, there's a few smaller differences in the Pali version. The Pali version, for example, says that those for his sake one has done evil, they will not come themselves to intervene. And it also does not mention these fond thoughts of the parents that I just read. And another difference is that in the Pali version, Sariputta every time introduces each of the cases by asking the Brahmin Dhananjani if it is better to earn the wealth required by means that are contrary to the Dharma or that in accordance with the Dharma. But these are just smaller differences. Yeah, so here we get the first part of the discourse, which to make practical sense for us, this topic end justifies the means. No. We, according to early Buddhism, if I do something evil for the sake of another, I still have to face the retribution. I cannot put it off completely. It is obviously, there's a difference in my volition if I'm doing evil just because I like to do evil or because I like to help somebody, but still the fact that I'm doing evil intentionally will have its results. I can't escape that and saying, look, I did it for somebody else, nothing doing. So now we come to the second part of the discourse. Excuse me for a second. Now, a little time has passed, and Dhananjani has become sick. And Sariputta hears that, and he goes to visit him again. So I read the discourse again for you. The Venerable Sariputta asks, Dhananjani, how is your ailment now? How much are you eating and drinking? Is your illness subsiding, not increasing? And Dhananjani replied, my ailment is becoming critical. I cannot eat or drink. My illness is increasing, not subsiding. Venerable Sariputta, I now have a headache so severe that it is as if a strong man were cutting my head open with a knife, causing extreme pain. Venerable Sariputta, I now have a headache so severe that it is as if a strong man were constantly tightening a rope around my head, causing extreme pain. Venerable Sariputta, I now have stomach pains so severe that it is as if a butcher were cutting it open, like the stomach of a live cow, with a sharp knife, causing extreme pain. Venerable Sariputta, my entire body is in such pain that it is as if two strong men had seized a weak man and were roasting him over a fire, causing extreme pain. Such are the painful feelings I am experiencing, and they are increasing, not subsiding. So it's very clear here our friend is in a rather critical situation. In fact, he's going to pass away soon after Sariputta leaves. He has intense fever, that image here of being roasted over fire, stomach cramps and a headache that feels as if somebody would be cutting open his head with a knife or tightening a rope around his knife. So this man is in a very painful and sick condition. And so Venerable Sariputta is now going to give him a teaching. Dhananjani, let me ask you a question. Answer as best you can. What do you think, Brahmin Dhananjani, which is better, hell or the animal realm? Dhananjani answered, the animal realm is better. We are back to our cosmology. And so Sariputta, step by step, takes him from a very low realm, so that his mind is directed to another realm. He goes to hungry ghosts, human beings. Then we get different celestial realms of the sense sphere according to Buddhist cosmology, the heaven of the four great kings, the heaven of the 33, the Yama heaven, the Tusita heaven, the heaven of gods who delight in creating, the heaven of gods who wield power over the creation of others, and the Brahma heaven. And on hearing the word Brahma heaven, Dhananjani is very excited. He really likes it. So Venerable Sariputta says, Dhananjani, the blessed one who is endowed with knowledge and vision, the Tathagata, without attachment, fully awakened, has taught four divine abidings, Brahma Vihara. These are Brahma dwellings, and these are the way to go to Brahma heaven. I continue to read. By practicing them again and again, a male or female lay follower can cut off sensual desire, relinquish thoughts related to sensual desire, and with the breaking up of the body at death, will be reborn in the Brahma world. What are the four? Excuse me. Dhananjani, here a learned noble disciple, with his mind imbued with loving kindness, dwells mentally pervading one direction, likewise the second, the third and the fourth direction, and also the four intermediate direction, and also above and below, all around, everywhere. With a mind imbued with loving kindness, free from fetters or resentment, without ill will or quarrel, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind that is boundless, exalted, immeasurable, and well cultivated. Similarly, he imbues his mind with compassion. Here comes the full text. With sympathetic joy, again the full description. And with equanimity, again full description. Free from fetters or resentment, without ill will or quarrel, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind that is boundless, exalted, immeasurable, and well cultivated. This is clearly, there's no object here. Or as Juliana pointed out, the actual mental quality is the object. And it's just a radiation all directions. But we continue with the discourse. Having taught Dhananjani the teachings relating to the Brahma world, the Venerable Sariputta rose from his seat and left. After the Venerable Sariputta had left Rajka and before he had reached the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary, while he was still in between these two places, the Brahman Dhananjani, who had practiced the four divine abidings and had abundant sensual desire and relinquished thoughts relating to sensual desire, with the breaking up of the body at death, was reborn in the Brahma world. Yeah, maybe I briefly stop here. The Pali version does not explicitly say that he practiced the four divine abidings, but the Brahma Viharas, but it also says that he was reborn in the Brahma world. So I think the situation is clearly this man is in a extremely sick condition. He has been living an immoral life before, but he has rectified that. But he does not give us the impression of being a great meditator. And he is on his deathbed. He has fever, stomach cramps, extreme headache. And he gets this radiation taught. And he is able to undertake it so successfully that he is reborn in the Brahma world. This is important because often this radiation is thought to refer only to absorption. But it is difficult to see how often Dhananjani, in that situation, could have developed absorption. It is perhaps possible that somebody who is a very skilled practitioner, there's a story about Ajahn Brahm, that he was able to go into very deep concentration even at the time when he was sick. But that is a monk who is one of the most skilled meditators that we have around. But here we have a layperson who was doing unwholesome conduct. He rectifies himself. He does not really give us the impression that he was a meditator and had jhanas before. And he's being taught this stuff for the first time. The moment of death, according to early Buddhism, is a very powerful moment. So this would explain how at the moment of letting go of sensuality and giving full importance to this radiation, that would enable him to be reborn in the Brahma world. But he must have been practicing this radiation. Without it, it's not possible for him to get this rebirth. And I think this helps us to see that this radiation cannot be meant only for those who have reached absorption. Yeah, there's a question by John Emmer, but I'm coming to that final part now that will answer the question. Manfred is asking if one needs all four to get to the Brahma world. I don't think so. I think one of them will be enough. Start with metta. I continue with the discourse. Seeing the Venerable Sariputta approaching in the distance, the Blessed One told the monks in the assembly, "The monk Sariputta is endowed with bright wisdom, quick wisdom, lively wisdom, keen wisdom, extensive wisdom, profound wisdom, wisdom that brings release, penetrative wisdom, eloquent wisdom. The monk Sariputta has achieved genuine wisdom. This monk Sariputta has just taught the Brahmin Dhananjani a teaching on the Brahma world. If he had taught him further, Dhananjani would have quickly realized the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma." Then the Venerable Sariputta approached the Buddha and, having paid homage at his feet, sat down to one side. The Blessed One said, "Sariputta, why did you not teach the Brahmin Dhananjani a teaching on going beyond the Brahma world? If you had taught him further, he would have quickly realized the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma." The Venerable Sariputta replied, "Blessed One, those Brahmins have for a long time been attached to the Brahma world. They delight in the Brahma world, take the Brahma world to be supreme, esteem the Brahma world, take the Brahma world to be ultimately real, and consider the Brahma world as being for them. For these reasons, Blessed One, I acted according to Dhananjani's wishes." In the Pali Sutta, we get the same basic point that John Emmer was already bringing up, that Brahma Viharas, rebirth in the Brahma world, is not the ultimate goal. But the disapproval of Sariputta's way of teaching is expressed in a much stronger way. First of all, the reciters of the discourse, the narrative voice of the discourse, they already make this comment. They say Sariputta has left after establishing Dhananjani in the inferior Brahma world. And he has left even though there still was more to be done by him. And then the Buddha says the same to other monks when he sees Sariputta coming from afar. See, in the Madhyama Agama, which we get first this whole list of his wisdom, and then just as a kind of afterthought. And then when Sariputta has arrived, the Buddha asks him directly, "Why you only established Dhananjani in the inferior Brahma world?" And so we get we get a stronger feeling of reproach in the Pali version compared with the Madhyama Agama discourse. However strong this reproach is formulated, the basic point is that according to Buddhist thought, there is something certainly superior to the Brahma Viharas and being reborn in the Brahma world. So, trying to come back to what this discourse can mean practically, the first part of the discourse that the daily demands in the normal living situation of laity have to be evaluated against the broader perspective of morality and of future results. That is, the end does not justify the means. Or we have to take responsibility for what we do. And the second one is again this, the way meditation is practiced, the Brahma Vihara practice. I have here just the case of metta. So it's a question of arousing this state of metta, which can be done with a thought, with a person, with an image, it doesn't matter. But all of these are crutches, as we already discussed. These are meant to help us. These are maps for the foreign town, but once we become familiar with the town, we no longer need the map. We know, oh, this is Kendi, this is the main road, here I turn right, there I turn left. We do not need to ask anybody, we know our way. So once you have come to that point of knowing what it feels like to have a mind of metta, of benevolence or loving kindness, then this just radiates. It is just a state that radiates in one direction, the second direction, the third, the fourth, above, below. It becomes like an ever-growing ball around oneself in all directions, just moves out in any direction. And this is free from any kind of unwholesomeness. In fact, unwholesomeness has very little chance to stay in that because the mind is so broad. That's a very interesting thing. The very quality of this is apamana, boundlessness. There's so much room and space. And if you observe a mind that has negative qualities, always needs a certain amount of narrowness. So the state of mind is free from fetters or resentment. There is no ill will or quarreling. And one just dwells pervading the entire world with the mind that is boundless, apamana in Pali. It's exalted, mahagata, immeasurable and well cultivated. So my point is that this, to me, feels quite different from what I learned in the commentarial way. In fact, being a little personal, I was taught metta in the traditional way, where you have four objects, oneself, a friend, a neutral person, and an enemy. And to each of these, I generate a certain type of thoughts, like, may I be happy and free from illness, etc. And I did this for quite some time, and nothing whatsoever happened. It just didn't work for me. So I'm just talking about myself. I'm not saying that others might not find this very, very useful. I'm not wanting to criticize this approach. This has been practiced and taught widely in the Theravada tradition. It must have benefits. It must be a good method. But for some people like myself, this doesn't work. One, it was too intellectual. Obviously, sitting in front of you, being a professor of Buddhist studies, there must be some problem with too much in the head. And the other thing was also that the objects were a disturbance for me. Even myself or the friend or the neutral person, it was always like a docking place for getting involved into associations and things. And my great discovery was when I was still in my early days in Sri Lanka, and I just opened one of these Pali books, and I see how they describe it there, and I just thought, let me just try this out. And it worked so powerfully. And this is actually little secret. This is actually where I come from. This is why I started to go for the suttas, why I started to do the Satipatthana study, then go for this comparative study. This is actually this one experience of how powerful this works if I allow myself to take off those glasses of tradition through which they keep on looking at things and look at it directly, look at what the sutta says and just try to make sense out of it on my own. And then put back the glasses and see what works or what doesn't work. And this is still my favorite practice. And I'm going to write a book on this, obviously. Yeah. Yeah, that was basically, I had promised last semester we were touching on the topic of metta, and I had promised to say a little bit more about this. This was basically the type of practice that I wanted to present to you. This kind of, as Juliana rightly says, to let the condition itself be the object of the mind, the metta or whatever, and to just allow it to radiate in all directions. This is not a forceful radiation, not a kind of pushing and let me get the next direction and I've only this village, I need to catch the next village. It's just an opening of the heart. An opening of the heart that lets go of boundaries and frontiers and which allows itself to be as open, as wide as the sky so that any kind of unwholesome reaction or thing, as soon as it manifests, it dissolves. It has nothing, it has no ground to stand on. Olga, that must be extremely difficult to practice Brahmavihara through one is in such a sick condition. I would think that one has to have a really strong mind to be able to radiate them. Maybe that's why rebirth in a higher realm was gained by that even without jhana attainments. Yeah, it must be rather difficult to practice in that condition. I also think so. And I think he just had very strong faith in Sariputta. And then there's something that one says sometimes about sick people, that when they get to a certain level of pain, the pain just switches off. It's so much the mind no longer takes it in. And somehow he must have really opened up his mind and done this radiation thing. Otherwise he would not have been able to get rebirth in the Brahma world. And then in early Buddhist thought, there is the belief the moment of death is a rather crucial one. The moment of death, you can accomplish a lot. There was just a discourse I was looking at lately. I don't know if I have the time to find it. Yeah, maybe I'll find it. It's about how a layperson should teach another layperson who is sick. And there's a progressive letting go that this lay person is teaching the other lay person, like you let go of your family, you let go of your possessions, you let go of concern with the five pleasures of the human world, the heavenly pleasures, and you direct your mind to nirvana. And at the end of the discourse, when the lay person is actually able to direct their mind towards nirvana, there's a saying in both versions, Pali and Madhyama Agama, the liberation of a lay person at the moment of death at this time is just the same as a monk who has been liberated for even 100 years. Yeah, I see if I can quickly find that so that I can give you the reference. Yeah, I have it, I think. Just for anybody who likes to look it up. This is the Pali version, Samyutta Nikaya 55-54, Samyutta Nikaya volume 5, 409. I hope I've given the right one now, because I'm just quickly brushing it up. Yeah, I think it's the right one. Okay, Lisa said, sickness also forces letting go. Yes, very good. Good point, in fact. Yeah. Stuart Corner, Bhante, can we be sure that Dhananjani had not attained absorption here? No, Stuart, we cannot be sure. How can we be sure? But we are dealing with probabilities. A person who, this Brahmin was evidently a very busy person. These Brahmins had this administrative responsibilities towards the king. And he is so busy with his work that he is even doing immoral deeds. And then he first has to be taught to behave morally. when he was doing that immoral stuff, there was no way he could have brought jhana. And so then he's being taught to behave properly, but Sariputta takes him through all these kind of rebirths. Sariputta would have known or would have been able to know that this person, the level of development of this person, so if he takes him to the realm of hell and hungry ghosts and all this, these may have been perspectives that this Brahmin was actually facing at that time. So as far as we are able to tell from the discourse, this person does not look to us like a normal absorption attainer. I'm wondering about previous life attainments. Yeah, but that is possible. But, I mean, the main point is a natural reading of this discourse does not give us the impression that the radiation of metta or the Brahma Viharas necessarily requires absorption attainment. That is the main point. Juliana? Jhana, not jhana, seems more an issue for non-return, not necessarily for Brahma world qua Brahma world. Yeah. Well, normally one needs jhana to be reborn in the Brahma world, but it is also possible if one gets into a state that is totally free from sensuality to be reborn in the Brahma world. That's true. Yeah, so I mean, I think a natural reading of the indications given in the discourse do not give us the impression that the meta description we have here in front of us is something that can only be done with absorption. It seems that this is something, and I can confirm that from my own practice, that this is something one can do at a level when one has not yet reached absorption. So, time's over. Got only one discourse, but this is a very important topic. And thank you very much for listening to me and for being there with me. And I look forward to see what's happening on the blog about this whole issue of Brahma Vihara and practice, and I see you next week.